Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Construction Law Committee's May meeting. We have a CLE presentation today from Fred Dudley. And as is our usual practice, we'll be recording the meeting today and releasing it as our podcast. We'll start by announcing our officers. I'm Marty Roberts, the chair of the Construction Law Committee. Our vice chair is Scott Pence, and our other vice chair is Lee Weintraub, and our secretary is Robert Doan. We'll get going with our normal business. I guess, first of all, let's approve minutes from last month's meeting. Get a motion to approve out there, anybody? Second, anyone?
Second.
Okay. We'll consider the April minutes approved. One announcement for you. I consulted with Ty Thompson and Bruce Partington about the surety and insurance subcommittee we've got, which you all may recall is kind of duplicative in subject matter for the real property division's insurance and surety committee, and we thought it did not make sense to keep having a surety and insurance or a surety subcommittee within the CLC anymore. So we've gotten rid of that subcommittee. In the future, we will just to have a liaison or an update from the other committee as to what's going on to keep abreast of what's happening in surety world. So with that, we'll move on with our meeting. First up is our ABA forum liaison, Carrie Wright.
Yep. Hardy, we had our annual meeting down in Boca Raton last month. It was a great success. I think we had 80 or 90 Florida construction lawyers at that meeting. So it was a great showing, and it was Steve Lesser's last meeting as chair of the forum. Our next meeting is going to be in Austin. It's going to be an ADR summit. I think Deb Mastin and some others on this call will be very involved in that meeting, and that's going to be October 8th and 9th. And it is also going to fall right in the mid-weekend of a two-weekend thing of the Austin City Limits Festival that they have. So if you're able to go to that, you really want to book your rooms early, as well as try to get tickets if you want to go to the Austin City Limits. I think they just went on sale this last week, and apparently it just sells out quickly. So really make an effort to attend, and if you can, secure your rooms and your tickets early. Then in October, the 21st through the 24th, there's the Forums Trial Academy. They only do that every other year. It's limited to 36 spots, and it's held at the U.S. District Courthouse in D.C. They have a top-notch faculty, and you get able to have a week of trial experience in the courtroom, and apparently from everything that I've heard and then reported, it's getting rave reviews in the past, and they usually sell out. And so it's, you know, again, limited to 36 spots. And then the midwinter meeting is in San Francisco next year, January 21 through 22. And then the annual meeting is going to be April 28 through the 30th in Nashville. Again, this is a good time of the year to get involved with the forum. It's kind of a slow time from the standpoint of the next meeting is not until the fall. So you can get involved in a division, and as their projects are getting started for next year, it's a good time to really get involved with a division. Again, there's 13 divisions, something that would fit anyone's practice, and you know, we'll be glad to get anyone and the CLC involved at any level they want to try to participate. And that's my report.
Very good. Thanks, Carrie. Next up is our ADR subcommittee that's chaired by Deb Mastin. Deb couldn't make it today, but we've circulated her written report where you'll see that the subcommittee is planning to circulate a request for arbitrators and mediators to fill out a directory with information about themselves and put that together as a service to the Construction Law Committee. And thanks to Brent Zimmerman, who's also doubling as our webmaster, who is going to help put together an interactive spreadsheet so that various folks can fill that out. So more to come, and looking forward to getting that online. Next up is the Certification Exam Committee, an update from them. That's a committee of the Real Property Division. Fred, what do you have to share?
We have 45 people taking the exam this Thursday in Tampa. And we're going to have a grading session of the committee on the 5th of June. So with the new format of four so-called short essays, it looks like we're going to have about 210 essays for eight people to grade, and we use teams of two. So we're going to have a very busy day or two grading the exams. The multiple choice, of course, are graded, you know, by staff because that's just simply a matrix. But we have to try to evaluate the essays, of course, very subjectively, but as objectively as we can. So we should have a new batch of certified construction lawyers, which could take us up to 400 by August.
Wow.
Yes.
So, Fred, when you all grade those essays, do you all meet in person somewhere and stay
yes.
on site and do that for 2 days?
Yes, under armed guard.
Under armed guard. Very good.
Yes, we do it face-to-face. Now, this time, our ninth committee member is not going to be able to attend in person, I believe due to the delivery of a baby that his wife is having.
That's a good excuse.
He will be given it's a good excuse. And so he's going to be grading separately, but otherwise we're face-to-face.
Very good, Fred. Thanks for the report. That's amazing
You're
to think
welcome.
Of 400 certified construction lawyers.
Well, we've got almost 700 on this committee, so we got a ways to go.
Yeah. All right. Next up, the certification review course, another committee of the Real Property Division. I know Deb's not here. Brian Renzio, are you here with us?
Yeah, I sure am, Hardy. No report except to say good luck to the participants taking the test.
Yeah, there you go. You guys are going to see how well you did, I guess, on the review part for your attendees. Reese Henderson, Construction Law Institute, anything to share?
Just briefly, Hardy, again, we're putting together or starting to put together a program for next year's Institute. So if anybody thinks they have an interest in presenting, by all means, send me an email. And let me know your interest as well as the topic you propose to speak on. Or if you just have what you think is an interesting topic you think we ought to consider, send that along as well. We received a handful of evaluations from folks from this year's Institute with some suggestions, but we're always looking for more. So, and if you have any consultants as well that you work with that you like a lot, you think would be good presenters, you know, send any suggestions my way, and we'd appreciate it. And that's it.
Thanks, Reese. All right. Next up is the Construction Litigation Subcommittee, Neil Sivier.
Hardy, it's RJ Hoy. Neil's out today, so I'm going to fill in and give his report for him.
Thanks, RJ.
Sure. Construction Litigation Subcommittee, in partnership with the Real Estate Litigation Subcommittee section, is going to put on a webinar on November 9th, the subject matter is going to be what must a real estate practitioner do when a client comes to a failed project. Some of the logistics are still being worked out. It could be a call in and listen kind of oral webinar, or we may do a film it actually from Stetson Law School, but we're going through some of the pros and cons and logistics of that, and that's where we are. So if anybody continues to have interest in getting involved with that, email Neil directly, and that's any questions that'll
very good. Thanks, RJ. Next
RJ,
up,
didn't you put out an email for speakers?
we did. My recollection from our last meeting, Fred, is that from our last, you know, subcommittee meeting, is that I think we were doing pretty well on from the construction law committee in terms of volunteers. I think we may have been still been gathering them from the real estate litigation subcommittee. But to the extent we do need any more, we'll shoot out an email.
Excellent. Thank
you. What did you say the topic would be, RJ?
What must a real estate practitioner do when a client comes to them with a failed project? We probably need to make that a little catchier, but that's the general topic.
All right, very good. Thanks, RJ. Next up, our Construction Regulation Subcommittee's report with Fred Dudley and Steve Sellers.
Skip me just a moment, please.
Sure. You want to always skip and come back to you?
Exactly.
All right, very good. Construction transactions with Clara Margaret Groover. I know Clara Margaret, I think she...
I'm on.
You are on. Good. I know. Yep. You sent me an email with a report, which we got out, and we'll turn it over to you, Clara Margaret.
Okay. I have three cases for us to review, and there's a recurring theme here: words count. And words will be interpreted according to their plain meaning. And if you don't know what the plain meaning is, use the dictionary. And I could probably stop right here, but let me just talk about the context in which these three kind of arise. The first is an arbitration agreement. These are more about transactions than they are about construction. That's why I want to scoot over them kind of quickly. But the validity of an arbitration agreement is an ever-popular theme with us in any case, and this is the validity of an arbitration agreement in a nursing home contract where the arbitration provision required the arbitration provision to be valid even on successive admissions to the facility. And on a second admission to a facility, this elderly lady died and her son had the estate and filed the lawsuit to go after the facility for malpractice. And what the facility had said in the arbitration agreement was that this provision would be applicable to all.
Claire Margaret, are you still there?
Sounds like we lost her.
I think we did lose her. All right. Well, we can maybe if she calls back in, we can fill that out. Fred, you ready to roll, or you want me to keep going?
Yes, sir. Ready to roll.
We'll turn it over to you for a report for construction regulation.
Thank you. With apologies, my partner Steve Sellers is home with a congested chest or whatever, so he is in bed today. But he reported on the two cases that I've included in our monthly report. And I think there are probably lawyers on the phone like Jeff Price that might want to talk about these. Not to put anybody on the spot, but the Cypress Fairway condo versus Bergeron Construction was a case that had to do with when the statute of repose runs on the, of course, the latent construction defects. As you know, the statute of repose is currently 10 years, and that was not changed by the legislature this year, by the way. And it begins to run upon completion of the contract. There's actually four triggers, but it's the later of. In this case, the court was asked to construe I think this is a fifth DCA case. Yeah, they were asked to construe what is completion of the contract. It is when the contractor finishes their work or when the contractor has been paid. And in this case, there was a difference of 3 days between those two events. But the lawsuit was filed in between those 3 dates, so it became critical to this issue became critical to whether or not the case would stand dismissed for statute of limitations / statute of repose or not. In this case, the court, the DCA, overruled the trial court and held that the completion of the contract means completion of performance by both sides, which included not only performance by the contractor, but payment to the contractor as well. So they left the cause of action surviving. Jeff, are you on the phone? Did you want to jump in? Jeff Price? Okay. The second case is Jack Utilities, Jack's Utility Management versus Hancock Bank. This is a very strange case because this was a lawsuit that the contractor, who did apparently about $500,000 worth of site work, filed it against the lender after the lender had foreclosed, which is very interesting. Also, the contractor, the site developer, apparently never filed a claim of lien. So what they were trying to do is gain some priority, I think, over the lien proceeds as opposed to over the real estate, but the case is not clear. But they were trying to claim that they were entitled to some of the loan proceeds, which, you know, this is a case where the bank had shut down the project early on. Their argument was based on unjust enrichment and equitable lien. The troublesome thing about the case is that the first district, as I read this case, says that those causes of action for unjust enrichment and for equitable lien are actually common law remedies that are preempted by the statute. I think somebody's on the phone. Somebody's on the phone. Hello. Thank you. That was even worse.
Either that or somebody's got a sound effects board.
Yeah, exactly. Give them some oil. So I think it's a troublesome case. I don't know why the contractor didn't pursue the statutory remedy, but for one thing, by the time he filed suit, he was long past the one-year statute of limitations for foreclosing a lien, although he'd never filed a lien. So it's a bit of a strange case, but it does seem to call into question all those complaints out there that we've been filing for years that say, yeah, not only do we want to foreclose the statutory lien, but if there's any problem with that, we want an equitable lien, and or we want to be paid for unjust enrichment. So,
hey, Fred, doesn't that fly in the face of the language in Chapter 713 that specifically says it's not an exclusive remedy? I mean, isn't there language to that effect in the statute?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always interpreted that to mean you can sue for breach of contract. But this case only dealt, as I read it, with the unjust enrichment and the equitable lien theory. It's a troublesome case, and I think we're going to need to keep an eye on it. Anyone else want to comment? I know there's probably some strong feelings about this case. Okay. Then let me just call your attention to other things very quickly. For those of you who represent licensed contractors, or especially those who want to become licensed, I pointed out several things with the Construction Industry Licensing Board, starting on page 2, including their proposed amendment to Rule 61G4, 15.001, where they want to add habitable to the work experience requirement. I'm not sure they have the legislative authority to do that, but I think they're going to pick up the definition of occupiable, which is actually a word used in the Florida Building Code, but we'll see how it goes. There's also a petition for deck statement filed by Ramon Valerio that was filed just last month, seeking a determination of whether or not he needs a license to perform such things as management of subcontractors, et cetera, Hello. Yes, construction management requires a license. And the board has ruled that many, many times, including in a petition for deck statement back in 2012. I think you can read the rest of it. There was not a lot of activity in rulemaking this month, maybe because of the legislative session, I'm not sure. And then I've given you a list of the six bills that are construction-related, which passed this year, which I'll speak more about in our CLE. Thanks.
Thanks, Fred. And Claire, Margaret, I got a note from you that you're back, so do you want to finish up?
I'm sorry about the technical difficulty. But what happened, I just thought the comparison between the two arbitration provisions was interesting, and then, of course, the litany of principles of contract interpretation are recited in the case. The case is a little more interesting from the standpoint of the analysis, probably because the Court of Appeal, in their opinion, were so professionally snarky about the judge's decision at the trial court level, and this was in a it was a fee agreement between appellate counsel and trial counsel. Trial counsel had called in the appellate lawyers to counsel them to be able to avoid harmful error in the trial court, and they were awarded $13 million. And because of the wording of the fee agreement, it was going to make a difference of a percent whether certain events had occurred before or after post-trial motions. And it really, I almost titled this, depending upon what the definition of is, because the word settle was the focus, you know, the focal point of this. This is the decision where the appellate court went into all of the recitation about using the American Heritage Dictionary and Black's Law Dictionary to determine the meaning of settlement. And, of course, at the end of the day, they really were very uncharitable about how the trial court had reached an absurd result when contract interpretation needs to follow the plain meaning of the words. The entire contract should be read as a whole and no provision in isolation, and that it should not be interpreted in a way that would bring an absurd result. Now, obviously in our construction work, we have the ambiguity of a term in order to get parole evidence in, but as we continue to try to educate the judges regarding custom and usage in the construction industry, I just offer that as a kind of an amusing and painful case that you can use to encourage the judge to be sensible if you're arguing for the plain meaning. The other case that I raised really has a lot more to do with transactional work outside the contract. And in this particular case, a lawyer, this was not the focal point of the case, but it really was important for us from a transactional standpoint, because there was a dispute in the lease agreement between the exclusivity provision and whether the tenant had a right to renew a lease. And it really turned on whether there was a default at the first exercise of the renewal option. The court said that there wasn't, and what they used was a piece of evidence. It was a letter that the landlord's attorney had written, which essentially, although it didn't describe it as waiving, it actually waived the default. And as best I can tell, it appeared that the letter was general in its reference to what the default elements were. And so I only add this in here as a reminder to all of us on how important it is to be specific and comprehensive regarding the details of whatever it is that we're addressing, so that we don't inadvertently waive an important position for our clients. And that's sort of the brief review of
words today. Hardy?
Sorry, I'm here. Thanks, Claire and Margaret. I had you on mute. Next up is the Contractors University with Lee Weintraub and Carrie Wright.
We have our we have our first few dates already booked. The presentations are going to be in Fort Lauderdale on September 22nd, in Tampa on November 5th, and in Orlando on March 23rd of next year. The speakers have already been recruited. We've already had our orientation conference call with the speakers so they understand the unique presentation style and format and requirements that we're looking for this program. And at this point, the committee is going to turn its attention to marketing and getting CEU accreditation for the for the contractors and other logistics like that. That's where we are.
Excellent. Thanks, Lee. Legislative Subcommittee, Scott Pence.
Thanks, Hardy. Not much to report on today because Fred's going to be covering most of it. The only thing that I will say is that there is a real property problem study, I think I got that right, of the section has over the past few months been proposing some changes to the priority of liens section within the Florida construction lien law. And we are currently looking at the latest version of that they've sent over to us, and we'll be responding. I know that we reviewed some of those changes as a subcommittee, and there were several issues that were raised and concerns. And so we're going to be looking at that to see if there's a way that we can try to address those and get that to a point where we would be happy with it. And so stay tuned.
Very good. Thanks, Scott. Next up, Membership Subcommittee. I heard from Arnie, no report. This is the first month in a few where we have not had at least one new member. So holding steady at, I think, 628. Newsletter, Jared Smith. Jared could not be on the call, but he sent me an email. We are on track to have the first.
Hardy.
Yo.
Hardy. I'm actually here, so I was able to break away from the training that I thought I had to go to, but it was
excellent. Take it away.
So where we're at right now is, and I did talk with Fred a little bit just to bounce some ideas off him, and probably we'll do that a little bit more with a little extra time. But at this point, I would like if everyone who is a subcommittee chair or co-chair or whatever, you know, so if I could get a reporting from everybody in all the different subcommittees, if you could shoot me an email, and I'll give you my email in just a second, and Hardy has it too in case you miss it, but if you could shoot me an email just identifying who you are and what your committee is, and then giving me a little something. This is going to be a quarterly newsletter. It's going to come out June 5th. That's our, at least hopefully, our projected first publication date. So if you could just shoot me an email with something that just briefly says, here's when we're meeting, if you have any other small announcement of an activity that you're planning on doing, great. And even if it's not necessarily within the quarter, but anything that you would want announced. And so I'll have my plan is to have kind of a page dedicated to that. It might even be close to the front page or back page. I'm working on the formatting, but so that everybody in all their committees, we can all just look at it at a glance and see where these committees are, who's who, and what's being done with each one over a certain period of time. And so if that's step one. And then step two is anyone who speaks, like for instance Fred today when he speaks, if you could shoot me an executive summary of your talk. And by executive summary, I mean literally could be 50 to 100 words. If you want to go a little bit longer than that, if you had a lot of content, that's fine. We'll work it in. I would like to have executive summaries of all the talks so that people can look at that. The goal being to maybe put a hyperlink, have a connection to the hyperlink, because this will probably go out obviously by email, so people can just click on that and then hopefully be able to click into the podcast if they missed that particular month's meetings, which I know we all try to make these, but it's tough to make every one of them. And then for the first article, and this kind of, I guess, goes to the publications committee folks as well, I would like one or two articles of 250 words. So these are not long articles. They're pretty short. I could probably just go with one, I would guess, for the first one. But two, if I have two, I can either use two or we can figure out maybe we'll use it for the next newsletter. But in any case, if anybody has an article they were thinking to do, I don't really have a topic picked by any way, shape, or form. But if you would like to be in the inaugural edition and you have an idea and an article that you would like published, go ahead and shoot me an email. And my email is the letter J, Smith, at Rumberger, RUMBERGER.com. And again, I think probably it's on my website. It's on our website at Rumberger. Hardy has my email too in case you missed that. So that's it.
Very good. Thanks a lot. I think the idea of doing the executive summary and linking it to the podcast will be fantastic, and we'll also be sure to get the newsletter on our webpage for the committee as well. Next up is Sean Mickley with Publications.
Hey, thanks, Hardy. It's Sean. And definitely the Publications Subcommittee would like to be involved in either trying to accumulate the articles for the letter or editing or reviewing those, peer reviewing those for sure. In terms of the word count, I think that's definitely doable and collecting those. So if anybody on this call has any interesting ideas, certainly shoot them to myself or the newsletter. And maybe somebody, maybe Jeff Price wants to write an article on the most recent 5th DCA case that came out. It seemed like he had a lot of good ideas in terms of how it may affect construction law down the line. Other than that, we don't have any other articles for publication in the Florida Bar Journal or Action Line at this point. So if anybody does have any lengthier articles outside of, 250, 500 words, something that you want to get published in the Bar Journal or Action Line, send it my way, and I'll certainly get some peer reviewers on it and hopefully get it published soon. So as always, you can email me at smickley, M-I-C-K-L-E-Y, at gouldcooksey.com, G-O-U-L-D. COOKSEY. And that concludes my report, Hardy.
Thanks, Sean. Next up, Small Business Programs with Lisa Colon-Heron.
Hi, Hardy. I have one case to report on today, and I'll send out the summary after I'm done. It's the Midwest Fence Corp. versus United States Department of Transportation. It is out of the United States District of Northern District of Illinois, which is in Chicago, and it comes almost 2 years after the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Associated General Contractors versus the Caltrans case. In that case, you recall that the Ninth Circuit had upheld the Caltrans DBE outreach program and effectively upholding the DBE program, the federal DBE program. Well, March 25th, 2015, United States District Court, Judge Harry Lewin-Weber, granted summary judgment across the board for the Department of Transportation, the U.S. Department of Transportation, and IDOT, which is the Illinois Department of Transportation, and the Illinois State Tollway Authority, upholding not only the federal DBE program, but also the DBE program as applied by the Illinois Department of Transportation and the Illinois State Tollway Authority to their state-funded construction projects. Midwest Fence was a non-DBE fencing and guardrail contractor, and it challenged the federal and the Illinois DBE programs, alleging that they violated the U.S. Constitution, the Civil Rights Act of both 1866 and 1964, and also the Illinois Civil Rights Act of 2003. Specifically, Midwest asked the court to declare the federal DBE program unconstitutional on its face, and it also argued that the program lacked congressional authorization and that the authorizing statute was unconstitutional. On summary judgment, the court found in favor of the defendants upholding the federal DBE program as constitutional and as applied constitutionally and Illinois. And at the heart of the case, and if you're really interested in this kind of stuff, you should read this case and I'll send it to you. But at the heart of the case was the validity of the various disparity studies used to substantiate the DBE program. First, the court took judicial notice of all of the evidence presented to Congress in the last reauthorization, which I believe was in 2012, of the federal DBE program, including all of the statistical and the anecdotal evidence. The defendants, the USDOT and IDOT, also presented a report by Dr. Wayne Bridge, who is a very famous statistician that does this type of work. He presented an expert report that considered 95 disparity studies and availability studies concerning women and minority-owned businesses. And those studies looked at over 100 public agencies in 32 states. And the conclusion of those studies, and of Dr. Wainwright, was that 66% of those studies indicated that DBEs were significantly underutilized relative to their availability. Ultimately, the defendants argued that the disparities showed by various studies were not attributed to factors other than race and sex and were consistent with the presence of discrimination in construction and construction-related professional services. Midwest, the plaintiff, argued that the defendant's evidence was flawed because the expert had failed to account for capacity when measuring availability. So according to Midwest, the failure to account for capacity skews the results of the availability and disparity study. In support of his position, Midwest pointed to the Roth development case, which was out of Texas. And in that case, the court had thrown out the disparity studies used to support the federal DBE program at that time. But the court pointed out here in distinguishing Roth that the disparity studies in the Roth case was only looked at one state in two counties and three cities. So the court here found that there was much more evidence presented. The court also concluded that non-DBE subcontractors like Midwest were not unduly burdened by the defendant's DBE program. One of Midwest's arguments was that the program unduly burdened predominantly majority-owned subcontractors that are small and specialized in trades where DBEs tend to operate, and the court disagreed, reaffirming the longstanding precedent that some sharing of the burden of affirmative action programs among majority-owned businesses is constitutionally permissible. In the end, at the end of it all, the court found that Midwest really did not present any evidence to rebut the defendant's affirmative evidence of disparity, and so summary judgment was granted. That's all I have, Hardy.
Lisa, thanks very much for sharing that and giving us that update. Next up, and we're getting near the end, website subcommittee, Brent Zimmerman, anything to update? No announcements there. Tech subcommittee, mostly we're just doing the podcast, but actually it's kind of cool that we're getting other things happening out there in terms of getting the interactive directory and that kind of thing. Let me remind you all that there is a link in the email this morning with the agenda where you can register and record your attendance. It's important for us to have a take on who's here, and it's a good record for you to know if you were at a meeting when later you're applying for your CLE credits. So with that, I will remind everyone that when Fred starts speaking, we will put this in lecture mode where Fred will speak and we won't be able to hear you. But when he's done, we will unmute it. Fred, you called in with the leader pin?
I did.
Very good. Angela Covington's not here. We do need speakers for the next couple months, so if you would like to speak on a topic, please reach out to Angela or email me, and we will get you slotted in and set up and let everybody know what's coming up in the months ahead. Scott, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Thanks, Hardy. For most of you on the call, Fred needs no introduction at all, but for those of you who don't know Fred, he's a partner at Dudley, Sellers & Healy in Tallahassee. He's a board-certified construction lawyer with over 45 years of experience in real estate and construction law. He's a member of the executive councils for both the Real Property Probate and Trust Law section and the Administrative Law section. He practices statewide from Tallahassee, Florida, where he located in 1998 after 16 years of legislative service in both the Florida House of Representatives and the Florida Senate, in which he served as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. As a legislator, Fred chaired the study group that rewrote Florida's construction lien laws, Chapter 713, and he successfully sponsored every statutory change thereto from 1990 to 1998. As a legislative advocate for the past 16 years, Fred has continued to draft most of the state laws governing contracting activities in Florida, representing such groups as National Association of Home Builders, Florida Home Builders Association, Aluminum Association of Florida, and Florida Swimming Pool and Spa Association. Fred's construction law practice includes state licensing, lien litigation, administrative proceedings for rule challenges and license discipline, lobbying in Florida legislature on behalf of numerous clients, and serving as a litigation consultant and expert witness, as well as appearing before several different regulatory departments. Fred is currently a consumer member of the Board of Building Code Administrators and Inspectors and serves as chair of the Bar's Construction Law Certification Committee. In 2008, Fred received the Lifetime Achievement Award awarded from the Construction Law Committee through the Construction Law Institute. I could go on, but in the interest of getting to Fred's legislative update today, I'll hand it over to you, Fred.
Hey, I told you to just say, here's Fred, but that's fine. Thank you.
Conference
is now in silent mode.
What's that, Scott?
I say, here's Freddie. That's what you asked me to say, but I figured you deserved a little bit more than that.
Well, thank you. The materials I sent out to you are really kind of slim because what I did was in addition to sending you a cover page and a table of contents page, I actually sent you copies of the enrolled copies of the six bills that passed. I'm going to talk about the details of each bill a little bit, but I wanted each of you to have the bills themselves so that you can read them from your point of view or as you may apply it to cases that you're currently working on. So I didn't want to over-editorialize the bills themselves, but I'll do that in the next over the next 30 minutes. The first thing I point out to you is that an enrolled bill, if you're looking at a bill, make sure you look at the enrolled version. You might find 6, 7, 8 versions of a bill between the two chambers, but only the enrolled version is the one that passed both chambers, and that's the one you need to work off of. If it says engrossed, that simply means it was passed by one chamber, but it's not enrolled until it's passed by both. So be careful when you're looking at these bills to look up in the top left-hand corner and look for the word enrolled. If it's not there, you probably do not have a copy of the bill as passed. Also, as I point out to you in my notes, these bills have to be presented to the governor, except for joint resolutions, constitutional amendments, and memorials to Congress. Every bill has to be presented to the governor, who then has, after a session has adjourned, then has 15 days, midnight of the 15th day after receipt, to either sign the bill, of course he can sign it the first day, to veto the bill, or to just simply do nothing and allow it to automatically become law on midnight of the 15th day. There is no deadline for when the officers, that is the Senate President and the House Speaker, have to sign the certificate to the governor certifying that the attached copy is the version that passed, nor is there a deadline for literally presenting that certification with the bill to the governor's office. So the 15 days does not start to run until the bills have been presented to the governor. And in the case of today's bill, we have two that were presented to the governor last week on the 7th of May. So he will have no later than midnight of the 22nd of May, which is a Friday, to sign, veto, or allow him to become law without his signature. And that's under tab 4, Senate Bill 466 on alarm systems, and tab 5, Senate Bill 778 on public works contracts, each of which I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about and then open it up for questions. House Bill 87 are the changes that were made to Chapter 558 on notice and opportunity to cure. This bill was requested by Association of General Contractors, which are for the most part the large commercial contractors. I believe the bill was pushed primarily by their South Florida chapter. They were concerned that the notices of claims that they were receiving, and I don't think they were really talking about the single-family residential jobs. I think they were primarily focused on the condominiums, that the notices of claim that they were getting were not specific enough. For example, one example they used with the sponsor of the bill, Representative Pasadomo from Naples, was, well, the notice says the sidewalks are cracked, but it doesn't tell us where they're cracked. Well, I said, walk around and look at them. How many sidewalks are there? But that was their best example, at least I thought the best they could do, to argue that the law needed to be changed. I argued on behalf of our client that it didn't need changing at all. But now the word temporary has been added to the definition of completion. That's not a big deal because there's actually cases on point. I think the Horizon West case being the predominant one, where the issuance of a temporary certificate, which is not unusual in phase projects and where there's multiple floors in a project, where the temporary certificate was used to trigger one of the association's duty to contribute to some of the common expenses. So that now is part or will be part of the definition of completion. It also requires a notice of claim to include the location of each defect, but that's based on a visual inspection only. And it says specifically the owner is not required to undertake destructive or other testing. And I thought when I wrote that other testing would be things such as a moisture meter reading and those types of things. Also, it has to be described without undue burden. Now, I'm sure the cases are going to develop to tell us what that means. But you're just going to have to pay more attention to and provide more detail in a notice of claim if you're representing the property owners. It also requires that the notice, it continues the present law, which has been there since day one, that the notice of claim does not trigger an insurance claim, but it adds, unless provided for under the policy terms. There's pending litigation that I'm aware of in Palm Beach County in federal court, and I'm sure there's other pending cases at the trial court level where contractors have sued their carrier, their insurance carrier, commercial carrier, and said, hey, that notice of claim I got triggered your duty to defend, and now I've run up $400,000 in costs, and I want you to reimburse me, to which the insurance carriers respond, well, you didn't notify us timely. So I suspect, this is just my best guess, I don't mind looking in the crystal ball because I've been eating ground glass for years, that the ISO, which is the national, maybe international, organization of insurance office that gets policy forms approved by the states, they're probably now going to come up with a policy form for each of the states because there's about 32 or 34 that have this type of law that will provide that when the contractor receives the notice of claim, that's the trigger to the duty to defend, and they're going to have to notify their carrier promptly or risk losing their coverage. Frankly, on behalf of a lot of my contractors, I think this is a stupid change for AGC to want. I think it's going to cost their members as much as it's going to gain them, but that's what they wanted to do. And finally, it adds maintenance records to the documents that have to be exchanged after the notice has been served, with the exception of any that may be privileged. The argument that AGC makes is that they believe that many of these so-called construction defects are not the result of faulty construction or faulty materials, but instead are the result of the owners not properly maintaining. For example, one of the biggest causes of construction defect litigation that we've been seeing for the last few years is water intrusion through stucco. Some of the defense lawyers maintain that if that building is not painted on a regular basis, the stucco itself will not seal out the water intrusion. I don't know if that's true. My engineers tell me it's not true, but then they get opposed in court every day. Secondly is HB House Bill 217 regarding the engineering board under Chapter 471. This creates a new licensure category called a structural engineer. It's a new license category, and beginning 1 March of 2017, everyone is prohibited from using that term or for practicing structural engineering or using a similar title such as licensed structural engineer without having this new license. Now, it defines structural engineer as a service of creative work that includes the structural analysis and design of threshold buildings. So it appears that the whole thing centers on the larger public buildings that we define elsewhere in statute as threshold buildings, such as theaters, auditoriums, sports venues, that type of thing. It's going to be interesting from a litigation standpoint when we start asking engineers when they're being sued for design flaws or failure to properly supervise, are you a structural engineer? And seeing what kind of arguments come out of the lack of someone having a structural engineer license. I strongly suspect that a lot of the engineering companies will look to the grandfathering under this bill, which says that you can apply, an engineer, a licensed engineer can apply prior to 1 September 2016 with an exemption from the licensing if they have 4 years' experience in structural engineering design or have been licensed as a threshold building inspector. This does require passage of a national 16-hour structural engineer exam, and that's why I suspect you'll see a lot of folks trying to get under the wire before next September 1 of next year. The next bill is House Bill 383, that amends the Burt Harris Act, which is found in Chapter 70. Some of you may recall the Burt Harris Act from 1996 was passed without any committee hearings in the House or Senate. It had almost no floor debate in the House. It had no floor debate in the Senate, and it was passed during the administration of Governor Lawton Chiles, who decided that he was going to build a cook shack at his hunting camp. Now, for those of you who are not hunters or you're not from North Florida, a cook shack is simply a screened-in room, usually detached from your hunting camp, so that if it catches fire, the camp doesn't burn to the ground. But Governor Chiles decided he was going to build his cook shack without any permits, without any licensed contractors. So two of his own agencies cited him for violations of law. And he was so angry, the story goes, and I was there, that he found that Burt Harris Jr., a conservative Democrat out of Lake County, who had filed this little bill And he liked it so well, the governor pushed it through and then signed it. And it's the Burt Harris Jr. Private Property Act. And so some of you may say, well, Fred, why did you include this bill as a construction-related bill? Well, in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Koontz, K-O-O-N-T-Z, versus St. John River Management District, i.e. Florida, reported it 133 SCT, or Supreme Court, 2586. That's 133 Supreme Court, 2586. Held the government cannot deny a land use permit based on an owner's refusal to accede to the government demands or pay money. These are cases, and the Burt Harris Act are applied to cases where government action has reduced the value of property, but it is short of a Fifth Amendment taking. So there is no required compensation except for the Burt Harris Act. This Koontz case involved the announced doctrine of unconstitutional conditions, which prohibits the government from denying a benefit to a person because he or she exercises or vindicates a constitutional right, even where no actual taking has occurred. And while the federal law has provided a cause of action for unconstitutional condition claims, although without much guidance as to damages, the Florida law is unclear. You may take a look at Section 373.617, which is applicable, though, unfortunately, to takings. Again, that's 373.617. So this bill creates a new Section 70.45 to provide a cause of action and monetary damages for landowners for prohibited exactions, that's the word, by government entities. And it defines that phrase as well as defining damages. Now, once a claim is filed, the government has the burden of proving that the exaction has, quote, an essential nexus to a legitimate public purpose and is roughly proportionate to the impact of the proposed use that the government is seeking to avoid, minimize, or mitigate, end quote. And that's the language right out of the Koontz case. The property owner has the burden of proving damages resulting from the exaction, which it basically involves determining the fair market value or the amount of the fee or cost that exceeds what is permitted. It also allows settlement agreements under the Burt Harris Jr. Act to be executed and entered into at any time. Current law is a little unclear, but there have been some cases that have held that unless the settlement agreement is executed within 150 days, which is the pre-suit risk assessment period that government is given, that unless it's filed or entered into within that limited time frame, it's not otherwise authorized. This bill clarifies that and says, no, the settlement agreement under Burt Harris Jr. Is valid, not depending on when it was entered into. It gives prevailing party attorney fees under most conditions. In fact, there's one section that gives attorney fees to the property owner, even if they don't prevail, as long as they prove that the exaction was prohibited. So in other words, where they don't have damage. They have an unconstitutional condition, but they don't have damages. They can still get attorney fees. And some of you are saying, well, wait a minute, Fred, that's all well and good, but sovereign immunity keeps me from suing the state. Well, in these cases, this bill waives sovereign immunity for the plaintiff to maintain the suit and to recover damages. So it's a powerful, powerful weapon for developers. It does not apply, by the way, to impact fees, non-ad valorem assessments, nor to floodplains required by FEMA, by the flood map. So those things are not considered unconstitutional conditions or extractions. The next bill is very simple. In fact, I think it's two pages long. Senate Bill 466. It actually amends Chapter 553, which is the building code section, but it also amends 489.5051. Now, 489.505, you might know, is Part 2 of Chapter 489, which is the electrical and alarm contracting and the electrical contracting licensing board. It amends the definition of low voltage alarms to exclude wireless alarms. And so there's a new definition of wireless alarms. No permits are required for wireless systems. No fees are required for wireless systems. And on the hardwired systems, it reduces the fees that local governments can charge to a flat $40. That used to be a step down phase-in, but it's now $40. We find more and more of our national clients are getting into the home automation, home security business, where they're using equipment that is basically plug and play. And it can lock and unlock the door. It can send notifications to your cell phone with a special application. It can notify you if there's an alarm, etc. We're seeing more and more of these come into the market with Cox, with Mediacom, and with a number of smaller companies who are trying to rush into the market. So those of you may come across some of these contracts. And again, if it's wireless as opposed to hardwired, it's not going to take a permit after the effective date. And I think, by the way, if I failed to mention it, all these bills are effective 1 July, except for, I think it's the, there's two of them that are not effective until 1 October. And before we hang up, here they are. The two that are effective 1 July is House Bill 383 under tab 3. House Bill 217, the engineering bill, is effective 1 July. They're all effective 1 July except tab 1, which is House Bill 87 on the Chapter 558, Notice and Opportunity to Cure, and the private property rights, House Bill 383, that I just described to you. Finally, is Senate Bill 778, dealing with public projects. This is an important bill if you have clients who are engaged in public works contracting. This bill goes to Chapter 255. Now, just a quick background. All state, county, municipal, and other public subdivision contracts for construction projects estimated to cost in excess of $200,000 must be competitively bid by state law, and that doesn't change. In addition, all of those entities that have contracts to improve a public building with projected costs in excess of $300,000 must also be competitively bid, and there are no exceptions. But local governments may establish by ordinance, or in the case of districts, I think they operate by resolution. They can set forth procedures for the bidding process. And if any of you have been involved, and I knew you have, in local bidding on construction projects, you know that frequently, such as Miami-Dade, they have an ordinance that sets preferences as to which contractors might get the work. This bill prohibits, it creates a new section, 255.0991, which prohibits, outlaws, local preferences based on the contractor, number one, maintaining an office or a place of business within that jurisdiction, number two, hiring employees or subcontractors from within that jurisdiction, or three, making prior payments of local taxes, assessments, or duties within a particular jurisdiction. Those are gone, or they will be soon. Now, this applies where 50% or more of the cost will be paid from state appropriated funds. That excludes federal funds, by the way. But if there's more than, if there's 50% or more state appropriated funds in that project, this new law would apply. Now, I told you that was the last bill, but I was wrong. The last bill is House Bill 1151 regarding building codes, and it creates a new section 553.794. Excuse me. If a licensed contractor, Division 1, so requests in writing, this new law requires the local building code administrator to create a residential master building program, which is designed to achieve standardization and to reduce the time spent by local building departments. The way it works is that the builder submits a general construction plan with truss specifications signed and sealed by an engineer and an energy performance calculation. Then they submit model designs, which may have up to 4 exterior elevations with not more than 3 alternative garage layouts, and those garages are limited to no more than 3 cars for some reason. And then once the master permit has been issued, all the builder has to do is submit the actual construction documents for one of those models and refer to the master permit, and they get a permit for each house. They do have to have a complete site specification permit application already on file, which reflects the master permit number. So it's not master permitting as we have commonly understood it to be, where one permit is issued per project that includes all the subtrades. It is instead a master permitting program that I suspect will apply to many housing projects and should make it less expensive and less time-consuming to start breaking ground. I'll be happy to answer any questions. And that concludes my report.
Conference is now in talk mode.
All right, Fred, we have everybody unmuted now.
Wonderful. Any questions? Well, I hope my editorial comments will be helpful to you, but there's nothing that substitutes for reading the actual bills, and that's what I have provided to you.
Fred, it's Rob Doan. Did you say, I'm sorry if I missed it, but did you know who was behind the creation of the 70.45, the exactions?
I don't really, but I know it's a spin out from the Koontz case.
Yep.
So I imagine it's probably some land use attorneys. You know, there's some firms that pretty much specialize in that.
Yep.
And honestly, Florida has never had a clear law on these unconstitutional conditions. The federal law has been pretty clear, Robert, but it doesn't really have a mechanism for determining damages that's very clear. So Florida has really now come into line with the federal government and provided some clear guidance as to the definition of damages.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that applies to folks like your school board, although it doesn't specifically say school boards. That would be a guess on my part. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think it does.
Okay. Any other questions?
I have a question, but I have a comment on this master permitting issue.
Yes.
If I understand it right, that they're going to, instead of, or maybe in addition to, a master permit by trade, they're also now going to have a master permit by parcel. I'm guessing that they're only going to require one notice of commencement then to go with that master permit, which then raises the question about what happens when different subs are working on different parcels within that housing development.
and now they'll get to do one lien that I guess will cover all these parcels, whether they worked on it or not.
I don't think so, Lee. And by the way, I apologize. I know you're one of our three vice chairs, and every time I write to Scott, I include every time I write to Hardy, I include Scott Pence and I include Robert Doan, and I forget to type in W. Weintraub. So please accept my apologies, old friend. I didn't mean to overlook you on that. I would say
he didn't know it. He didn't know until you just told him.
Well,
that's
I know,
right.
But he's a good friend, and I don't want somebody to tell him and then he wonder why I didn't tell him. So I'm confessing. Lee, I don't think so, because in addition to the master permit, you have individual construction plans for individual homes. Again, up to four different elevations, including alternative garage designs. But then you're going to go get a site-specific permit before you can break ground. So that's the point in time when they issue that permit that they're going to require. In fact, the staff analysis includes this. They're going to require, unfortunately, the recorded notice of commencement, like all the building departments are supposed to, apparently.
Then I think I'm confused about what they think they're gaining then with the master permit.
Time. If you have a subdivision, you know, where you go down the street and you see, you know, three or four or five or six different elevations and garages, they can go in and get a master permit for all of those models up front. And they do a plan for the entire project, a site plan. Then they come back and they do individual permits for the individual houses.
But so on the individual permits for the individual houses, they can just cut and paste what's already been approved as part of the master permit.
They can cut and paste as far as the plans are concerned and the elevations. What saves the time is that these master plans, if you will, these models have already been reviewed by the plan reviewer and approved by the building department. So if you come in with a permit that says, okay, I want to build house A with number 3 elevation on lot 13, and here, you know, here's my trust plan, and here's my elevation selection, then they can very quickly give you a permit because they've already reviewed the master plan, if you will. But you're still going to get an individual permit for each lot, for each house, and you should have an individual notice of commencement for each one as well.
Okay. It just doesn't seem to me like they're saving a whole lot of time, because if they have, let's say, 5 different elevations on a housing development, the first of each of those 5 that they're going to build, they're going to go through this plan examination. And then after that, they'll do the exact same thing they're doing now. So really, the only time you're saving is the time for the first of the houses under each elevation.
Well, I can only tell you what the staff analysis says, and the staff analysis usually reflects what the developers and builders are telling them.
Right.
So certainly the people that push this believe that it will save time and thus money. By the way, Lee, I'm sorry to also announce that among the bills that did not pass because of the House adjourning unconstitutionally on
the
Tuesday afternoon were your two public-private partnership bills, 63 and 65, one of which would have been the public records exemption, which has to be a separate bill. Also reminds me to point out that Senate Bill 224, which would have required contractors under public contracts to maintain public records as agencies do, did not pass. The statute of repose reduction to 7 years, House Bill 501, just barely made it out of the only committee hearing it had by a vote of 7-6. And that was back before session started, and it was never heard again, so it did not pass. And then finally, a major bill, 915, House bills are odd numbered, 915 would have made some major changes to the Florida Building Code, and it did not pass because frankly, some of the House members put in some poison pills, and the Senate refused to take them. So I don't know if that might be included in the call for the special session or not, but it got pretty close. Pretty close only counts, I'm told, in horseshoes. And hand grenade. Yeah.
All right, Fred. Thanks very much. Anybody else, anything to add about the legislative session? With that, we will call it a meeting, and we will see everyone second Monday in June at 11:30 a.m. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fred.